content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the June 14th, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has a picture of a U.S. Military fighter jet flying, and the pilot is looking up over his shoulder, and he sees a UFO, kind of a typical flying saucer, and in the dome you see a couple of aliens, maybe we used to call them Martians or something like that. And the title is Taking UFOs Seriously, Why the Pentagon is Urging Pilots to Report Their Close Encounters. And I believe that's a Talking Points page article. We'll try to pick that up later in the show. But we will start with two short main stories this week. First, a dramatic exit speech from a reticent Mueller. What happened? Special Counsel Robert Mueller broke a two-year public silence last week by clearly contradicting Attorney General William Barr and stating that his investigation had not cleared President Trump of possible criminal acts. He suggested that only Congress, through impeachment hearings, could resolve whether the 10 possible acts of obstruction of justice identified in his report amounted to crimes. In a 10-minute statement marking his final his official resignation, Mueller explained why charging Trump was not an option under Justice Department guidelines, noting that if his investigators believed President Trump did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Though Mueller implicitly acknowledged that only an impeachment inquiry would resolve the issues, he made it clear he did not want to testify before Congress, saying he has nothing to add to his report. We chose those words carefully, he said, before declining to take reporters' questions, and the work speaks for itself. Democrats are still pushing to question Mueller, although House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler said the Republican former FBI director doesn't want to participate in anything that he might regard as a political spectacle. Trump and his allies reacted to Mueller's muted statement with outrage. I think Mueller is a true never-Trumper, the president said, adding that the special counsel's office employed some of the worst human beings on earth. After tweeting, I had nothing to do with Russia helping to get me elected, Trump amended that, saying, I got me elected. Russia didn't help me at all. What the columnist said. Mueller went out like a lamb, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, when the country needed a lion. Determined to appear apolitical, Mueller was maddeningly indirect, almost deliberately obtuse. He refused to directly counter Barr's spin about why the report punted on a prosecutorial judgment. He could have said the special counsel's evidence should be referred to the House, or cited his finding that Trump's obstruction efforts failed only because his aides refused to go along with them. Instead, he ducked it. Trump goads everyone appalled by him to violate norms, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. What was the point of this farewell speech but to inappropriately influence the public debate? Casting aside neutrality, Mueller also ditched the presumption of innocence. In doing so, he reiterated the gobsmacking claim that he hadn't found conclusive evidence of Trump's innocence. Imagine how the American Civil Liberties Union would react if this extra-constitutional legal standard had been applied to anyone else. All Mueller did was summarize his conclusions, and conservatives erupted in outrage, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Apparently, they had failed to read the report, which detailed page after page of Trump's Nixonian-scale obstruction of justice in office. Mueller is following Justice Department guidelines as strictly as possible, sending his evidence to Congress without prejudice so that it can determine if crimes were committed. Yet some are choosing to believe Trump's slavishly loyal attorney general, insisting it must be Mueller who is lying about the Mueller report. And our second main story, Trump greeted with pomp and protests in UK. What happened? President Trump promised to reward the UK with a generous post-Brexit trade deal during a pageantry-filled trip to Britain this week, as thousands of demonstrators marched in London to protest his state visit. His trip began with controversy. Days before flying out, the president called the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, nasty after discovering the American-born wife of Prince Harry had threatened to leave the U.S. in 2016 if Trump was elected. And shortly before landing in London, Trump took aim at the capital's mayor, Saqid Khan, who said it was un-British to roll out the red carpet for a divisive president, tweeting that Khan was a stone-cold loser. But Trump received warm welcome from Queen Elizabeth II, who greeted him with an honor guard at Buckingham Palace and hosted a lavish state banquet. The president also met with Prince Charles, who spent 75 minutes asking Trump to take action on climate change. Trump told the heir to the throne that the U.S. didn't need to do anything, he later said, because it already has the cleanest climate. At a press conference with outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May, Trump promised that he would deliver a phenomenal trade deal with Britain once it left the European Union. The visit ended with Trump attending ceremonies in the English city of Portsmouth with World War II veterans and fellow world leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, to honor Allied forces who sailed from there 75 years ago on D-Day. What the columnist said: Trump will surely go home disappointed, said Tom Sykes in thedailybeast.com. A lifelong fan of the Windsors, the president apparently wanted a face-to-face with Princes William and Harry in front of the cameras so he could harness the popularity of the young royals. But Harry, angered by Trump's undiplomatic remarks about his wife, skipped the banquet, and William didn't join Trump on a tour of Westminster Abbey. The president must be fuming that he didn't get their royal seal of approval. This whole visit was a disaster, said Aaron Rupar in Vox.com. As well as insulting Markle and Khan, he outraged almost the entire nation by saying that Britain's beloved National Health Service would be on the table, presumably ready to be carved up by profit-driven U.S. companies during trade talks. He further embarrassed himself by tweeting that the protesters who thronged London, flying a giant blimp of a diaper-wearing baby, Trump, had actually gathered in support of the USA and me. The protests actually show Trump's strength, said Eddie Scarry in the Washington Examiner. Some wag projected on to the Tower of London the stat that 21% of Britons have a positive opinion of Trump, compared with 72% for President Barack Obama. That is because Obama kept Europe comfortable, while Trump demands that our NATO allies pay more for defense and refuse to undermine our economy by staying in the Paris Climate Change Accord. It's better to be right than popular. Our controversy of the week is titled Impeachment. Will Democrats Act on Mueller's Findings? Until last week, Democratic House leaders were reluctant to even discuss the prospect of impeaching President Donald Trump, said Kyle Cheney in Politico.com. But the tide may be shifting. The game changer was the surprise public statement by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who emphasized two key findings of his report: that if he could have cleared Trump of criminal behavior, he would have done so. And that, in Mueller's words, it requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. To Democrats, those pointed remarks sure sounded like a direct referral to Congress to take up Mueller's findings in impeachment hearings. Within days, a wave of House Democrats came out in favor of impeachment, with 59 publicly on board and many more leaning in that direction. "The sticking point is Speaker Nancy Pelosi," said Kevin Cruz in USAtoday.com. With polls finding that only about 40% of Americans currently support impeachment, Pelosi is worried that a backlash might cost Democrats both the House and the White House in 2020. But that's precisely why the impeachment process begins with a series of high-profile televised hearings, to help convince the public of its necessity. "If I were Nancy Pelosi, I wouldn't want to bet the House on that strategy," said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. Back in 1974, it's true, the Watergate hearings gripped the nation and swung public opinion decisively in favor of Richard Nixon's removal. But this isn't 1974. Nearly half of the nation now lives inside a conservative media echo chamber that would spin the hearings as just another vicious partisan attack on the president. Trump's inevitable acquittal by the Republican-held Senate wouldn't need much spinning, said Karl Rove in FoxNews.com. Trump will have won and Democrats will have lost, a fact that could cause a significant number of discouraged Democrats to stay home on Election Day. "You can debate whether impeachment makes sense politically," said Max Boot in the Washington Post, "but what about legally and morally? It's now clear that Trump has committed more criminal and unconstitutional conduct than any previous president in U.S. history. He gladly accepted and even publicly asked for Russia's campaign help, broke campaign laws by paying off mistresses, corruptly pocketed millions of foreign dollars as president through his hotels and businesses, and obstructed justice at least 10 times, by Mueller's count. Democrats seem to be hoping for a smoking gun that makes impeachment possible," said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com. "But Mueller just handed them a 448-page arsenal of smoking guns. What could once be justified as caution is now indistinguishable from cowardice." Those clamoring for impeachment think it's the most aggressive, effective action Democrats can possibly take against Trump, said John Marshall in TalkingPointsMemo.com. It isn't. Far more damaging would be multiple investigations methodically laying bare the sprawling totality of Trump's corruption and criminality. Impeachment would necessarily focus on one big question, remove or don't, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. That debate would draw attention away from the grisly details of Trump's wrongdoing. A barrage of investigations, on the other hand, will leave him trying to plug more holes in the dike than he has fingers, and severely damage him going into 2020. The wisest response to the moral calamity of the Trump presidency is the one most likely to lead to success. Let's see what we've got in our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for El Chapo, whose 91-year-old mother has been granted a visa to come visit the convicted drug kingpin in a U.S. prison. Consuelo Loera says she hopes to bring her son his favorite food, her enchiladas. It was a good week for urban millennials and other single people with limited storage space, who can now buy the Charmin Forever Roll, a 12-inch diameter toilet paper roll that can last up to 3 months, so you have one less thing to think about. And it was a good week for bar fighters after Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed into law a bipartisan bill repealing a ban on carrying brass knuckles. The previous ban was antithetical to our rights to self-defense, said Democratic State Representative Joe Moody. But it was a bad week for Tom Brady, whose plans to trademark the nickname Tom Terrific have sparked outrage from fans of Tom Terrific Seaver, 74, the Hall of Fame pitcher for the New York Mets. Brady is not getting his cheating, ball-deflating paws on Tom Terrific, said Mets fan Dom D'Angelo, 55. Get your own name. It was a bad week for voter ID. After 97-year-old former San Antonio mayor Lila Cockrell was turned away as she attempted to vote in a mayoral runoff election because she no longer has a driver's license or passport. Election officials say they knew who she was, but the law is the law. And finally, it was a bad week for self-inflicted wounds after a Trump supporter in London attempted to stab and deflate the Trump baby blimp flown in protest of his visit to the UK, but ended up only cutting her hand. I'm bleeding quite badly, attacker Amy Mora said in a cell phone video she made before being arrested. We're on the briefing page now, and this story might turn into a main story here in the coming weeks. The title is Hong Kong's Eroding Freedoms. Beijing is ratcheting up its efforts to strangle Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. What's at stake? Why is there a conflict? China has reneged on its promise to give Hong Kong a high degree of political and economic autonomy under the policy of one country, two systems. The latest assault on the city's independence is a new law rammed through by the Beijing-imposed chief executive, Carrie Lam, that would give China some control over Hong Kong's justice system. This extradition law would enable Beijing to pressure Hong Kong authorities to transfer certain suspects to mainland China, where the Kafkaesque court system uses forced confessions and closed trials to find 99% of defendants guilty. Beijing says the law is necessary to prevent Hong Kong from becoming a haven for fugitives. But critics say that it would render everyone, including Hong Kong residents and foreign business people and tourists, susceptible to Beijing's arbitrary justice. That prospect sent more than 100,000 protesters into the streets in April, and another demonstration is planned for June 9th. There is a lot of fear that once the extradition law is passed, we won't be able to come out to protest on the streets, demonstrator Cindy Ching told the Financial Times. We're worried they will use facial recognition to identify and charge us. What does China fear? Any challenge to its authority to maintain strict Communist Party control of its vast modernizing nation, the increasingly authoritarian government in Beijing is cracking down on dissent and independent thought. Originally, when Britain and China were negotiating over how the bustling British colony would revert to Chinese rule in 1997, Beijing indicated that Hong Kong would have a special degree of autonomy. But China's rulers were deeply alarmed by the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989. And when they drew up the Basic Law, the Hong Kong Constitution in 1990, they did not include direct democracy. Instead, they created an election committee, packed with pro-Beijing representatives, to select the Hong Kong chief executive, who is the equivalent of a governor. The legislature is only partly democratic, with half the lawmakers elected by the people. Direct democracy to elect Hong Kong's leaders was supposed to be gradually introduced. But in 2014, Beijing announced that when people could finally vote directly, they could choose only among two or three candidates selected by the Beijing-dominated committee. That prompted the student uprising known as the Umbrella Movement. What was this movement? Inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement in the U.S., three activists, Chu Yuming, Benny Tai, and Chan Kin Man, took over Hong Kong's downtown to demand true democracy. Tens of thousands of people turned out to block roads in the heart of the city for 3 months. Many wore yellow, and many more carried umbrellas. At first to shield themselves from the tear gas and pepper spray police were using, and later as a symbol of their protest. The protest ended with many arrests and no concessions from authorities, and the crackdown is still continuing. In April, the three leaders were sentenced to 16 months in prison each. Chu, 75, had his sentence suspended. What else have the authorities done? After the protest broke up, Hong Kong officials prosecuted dozens of pro-democracy activists, including 16 elected lawmakers. Six other lawmakers had their elections nullified on dubious grounds, giving Lam a pro-Beijing majority in the legislature. In 2015, agents from the mainland kidnapped five Hong Kong booksellers and forced them to confess to selling banned books. Last fall, pressured by Beijing, the Hong Kong government banned a pro-independence political party. What freedoms do Hong Kongers still enjoy? Hong Kong is a powerhouse of international finance, with a thriving community of foreign business people. It has a vigorous free press, and unlike on the mainland, its 7 million people have the right to demonstrate. Hong Kongers have their own passports. Residents of the city are not subject to China's oppressive social credit system, which assesses each citizen's trustworthiness with a numerical score and denies travel and other privileges to those who don't measure up. But the boundary between Hong Kong and the mainland is beginning to blur as Beijing builds physical connections to Hong Kong Island. Why is it doing that? To make a symbolic statement that Hong Kong is not truly separate. Last fall, authorities opened a 34-mile series of bridges and tunnels linking the Big Island with mainland China and semi-autonomous Macau. It also built a high-speed rail terminal to connect Hong Kong with the mainland cities of Shenzhen and Guangzhou. Democracy activists vow to continue to fight for the proud city's independence, but Fenella Song, coordinator of the expatriate group Friends of Hong Kong, says China casts an increasingly dark shadow. People are very concerned about the freedom of expression because no one can tell you where the red line is, Song says. You're always under fear. Hong Kong is dying. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. The first is titled, McConnell's Profound Cynicism. No one, including Donald Trump, has done more to destroy democratic norms than Mitch McConnell, said Robert Schlesinger. When Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died 11 months before the end of President Barack Obama's term, McConnell, as the Senate Majority Leader, refused to even hold a hearing on Obama's nomination of Federal Appeals Court Chief Judge Merrick Garland. To justify this unprecedented act of partisan obstruction, McConnell pompously argued that in an election year, the American people should have a voice in selecting the next justice. Last week, McConnell was asked what the Senate would do if Supreme Court vacancy opened up in Trump's last year of office. Smirking, he replied, "Oh, we'd fill it." That's all you need to know about McConnell's deeply cynical philosophy of governance, in which principles and norms are irrelevant and power is the only thing that matters. Consider McConnell's reaction when Obama asked him in September 2016 to join Democrats in a bipartisan statement publicizing and denouncing Russia's ongoing interference in the presidential election. McConnell refused. A foreign adversary was assaulting our democracy, but McConnell was unperturbed because they were helping his side. He is the embodiment of everything that is wrong with our politics. The surge of right-wing populism. Throughout the world, right-wing populism is ascendant, while liberalism is in retreat, said Ross Douthat. In the recent EU elections, far-right parties surged and captured an unprecedented number of seats. In Australia, Prime Minister Scott Morrison, an evangelical Christian who opposes liberal policies to combat climate change, won an upset victory. In India, Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi was reelected by an overwhelming margin. These results should chasten American liberals, who have convinced themselves that President Trump's election was an aberration, and that their own coalition is the real American majority. In reality, polling shows that only 18% of Americans agree across the board with Democratic positions on abortion, gun control, taxes, immigration, and other hot-button issues. The progressive belief in a hidden left-of-center mandate is a fond delusion. Yet liberal Democrats insist that their candidate adopt an inflexible, far-left agenda on both cultural and economic issues. Democrats might get away with this in 2020 because Trump lacks the political cunning of a true demagogue and needlessly alienates so many persuadable voters. But in the longer run, Democrats would be foolish to dismiss the angry populism that spawned Trump and so many leaders like him. This comes from Sweden. A green wave washes over Europe. Call it the Greta Thunberg effect, said Pernilla Ericsson. The teenage Swedish climate change activist has traveled all over Europe in the past year and inspired young students across the continent to join her Fridays for Future protest. Now we're seeing the political results. In the European Parliament elections, right-wing populist parties surged as expected. But the real story was the rise of the Green Party. In Germany, 33% of voters age 18 to 29 and nearly 21% of all voters cast ballots for the Greens. In France, the party grew to become the country's third largest with 13%, while in Ireland it took 15%. Here in Thunberg's native Sweden, the Greens won only two of the country's 21 seats in the European Parliament. But that's because they had a lot of environmentalist competition. All the parties of the left and center battled during the campaign to portray themselves as the country's strongest green voice. That's a reflection of Thunberg's influence. She didn't endorse any party, but she did push with enormous force and get the climate issue on the agenda. And remember, the 16-year-old and the youngsters she leads can't even vote yet. But they'll be eligible in 2022 when Sweden holds its next parliamentary elections. Then all parties will have to reckon with her generation. And on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Cowed by the Culture Cops. Online mobs are attacking the authors of young adult fiction for daring to imagine lives different from their own, said journalist Jesse Singal in Reason. Now publishers are canceling these releases, and new voices are being silenced. If you're looking for a case study in toxic internet culture, look no further than the online world of young adult fiction. That might seem surprising. After all, we're talking about boy wizards and sexy vampires and mawkish coming-of-age tales here, right? Here's the short version. In recent years, young adult, or YA, fiction has come into its own as a genre, reliably producing a small number of mega-hits that have turned their authors into millionaires. During that same period, it has begun to grapple with some difficult questions about diversity and representation. YA fiction, like many other areas of publishing, has a bit of a diversity problem, despite being a liberal-minded industry centered in New York City. But while the motivation behind the movement for more diverse voices is commendable, the manifestation of this impulse on social media has been nothing short of cannibalistic. The Twitter community surrounding the genre, one in which authors, editors, agents, adult readers, and reviewers outnumber youthful readers, has become a cesspool of toxicity. YA Twitter, as it's called, is a mess. Young adult books are being targeted in intense social media call-outs, draggings, and pile-ons, sometimes before anybody's even read them, Kat Rosenfeld wrote in New York Magazine's Vulture.com in 2017. YA Twitter features frequent over-the-top claims that various people in the community are abusing one another, with the term often used in a deeply watered-down sense. The scandals that loom so large on Twitter don't necessarily interest consumers. Instead, the tempest of these controversies remains confined to a handful of internet teapots, where a few angry voices can seem thunderously loud, Rosenfeld wrote. Still, some publishing professionals imagine that the outrage will eventually become powerful enough to rattle the industry. The worriers were prescient. In 2019, books are not only getting excoriated by online critics who haven't read them, they're getting unpublished entirely. Such an incident unfolded last winter with a book called Blood Air. Emily Nguyen Zhao, a woman of Chinese descent who was born in Paris and raised in Beijing, had won herself an enviable three-book deal for an Anastasia-tinged adventure. In the Cerulean Empire, went the publication materials, affinities are reviled and enslaved. Their varied abilities to control the world around them are unnatural, dangerous. And Anastasia Mikhailov, the Crown Princess, might be the most monstrous of them all. Her deadly affinity to blood is her curse and the reason she has lived her life hidden behind palace walls. The adventure kicks off when Anna's father is murdered and she is framed, forcing her to flee. The first book was due out in June. In January, though, there emerged a vague Twitter-centered whisper campaign against Zhao. A main allegation was that she had taken to capturing screenshots of other people's mean tweets about her, presumably in order to someday enact revenge, though no one provided any evidence she actually had done this. It was open season from there. People picked over the limited information about the book to find something, anything, to justify being angry. L.L. McKinney, a YA author who had recently published her own debut novel and who tends to be an active participant in these pylons, noted that some of the publicity material described Blood Air's fictional world as one in which oppression is blind to skin color. She tweeted, "Someone explain this to me. Explain it right the blank now," accusing the author of internalized racism and anti-blackness. The logic appears to be that because our world has racism, it's unacceptable to imagine a world that does not. Perhaps most inflammatory was the claim that a character in the book assisted Anna and then conveniently died in a manner redolent of the magical Negro, an American cinematic trope famously criticized by Spike Lee in 2001, in which a black character exists solely for the purpose of helping out or granting folksy wisdom to a white protagonist. During these pre-release blow-ups, hardly anyone had read the book in question. At this point, a forthcoming novel has usually been seen only by those who have received advance copies from the publisher. So it was here, Early reviewers began spreading the rumor that Blood Air treated a black character horribly. Yet the character in question, described by the author as having tawny and bronze skin and eyes that are startling aquamarine, doesn't actually seem to have been meant to be coded as black. The vagueness of the charges didn't matter. Zhao posted an apologetic tweet announcing that Blood Air wouldn't be published. The next cancellation occurred not long after. It centered on Kosoko Jackson, whose website until recently described him as a vocal champion of diversity in YA literature, the author of YA novels featuring African-American queer protagonists, and a sensitivity reader for Big Five publishers. Jackson is black and gay. This matters here a lot. And was preparing for a release of his debut young adult novel, A Place for Wolves, an adventure romance between two young men set up against the backdrop of the Kosovo War. The book was slated for release on March 26. Jackson had amassed some enthusiastic blurbs from established names in YA fiction, and he seemed poised for a successful debut, in part because Wolves was going to be a so-called hashtag own voices release, hashtag own voices being a hashtag coined by the YA author Corinne Duvis to highlight books that are written by an author that shares a marginalized identity with a protagonist, at the website BookRiot.com explains. Jackson, enforcer of social norms and a gay black man writing about gay black protagonists, should have been safe, right? Nope. It all came crashing down quite quickly. As with any internet outrage, it's hard to know exactly what sparked it. But a major turning point came in the form of a Twitter post about the novel. Quote, and this is all caps, "Hey, how about we don't promote or support books about a romance between and the victimization of two Americans set during a real-life historical genocide where the villain is part of the demographic that was ethnically cleansed," tweeted at Flight of Stars on February 25th. The tweet pointed to a review on Goodreads.com. Many YA readers and authors maintain accounts there, and it is the site of many an attempted YA kneecapping. After authors get targeted, they're often flooded with one-star reviews. "I have to be absolutely blanking honest here, everybody," this post starts. "I've never been so disgusted in my life." The reviewer proceeds to argue that it's insensitive to center a story set during the Kosovo conflict around two Americans. One character particularly grated on the reviewer, "Don't even get me started on the well-educated Muslim man, Professor Bakiri, who turns out to be a cold-blooded terrorist whose only person seems to be to murder and torture and commit harm, even killing his own men," she wrote. "I managed to obtain a copy of Jackson's book. It's not good. The writing is clunky and the characters are poorly developed. Bakiri is a laughably bad villain, a two-dimensional cardboard cutout. But at the time, many of those leading the charge against it had none of the context required to have an informed discussion about whether and to what extent Jackson handled his narrative task responsibly, including in his portrayal of Bakiri. Why? Because the general public did not have access to the book. As a result, the critics got a lot of basic stuff wrong. For one thing, the story doesn't feature two Americans, as many people claimed. The protagonist's boyfriend is from Brazil, not the United States. For another, Bakiri's religion isn't mentioned at all, even though many online outrage mongers made it sound as if he were portrayed as some sort of radical Muslim stereotype. Part of what makes this story so interesting is that Jackson himself has been on the other side of these online attacks on authors. His outspoken tweets during the Blood Air controversy, for example, fit neatly into Kat Rosenfeld's general description of his community's online surveillance tendencies. "Many members of the YA book Twitter have become culture cops, monitoring their peers across multiple platforms for violations." Jackson has also advocated for a very narrow conception of who is allowed to write which stories. Stories about the civil rights movement should be written by black people, he tweeted during one outrage outbreak. Stories of suffrage should be written by women. Ergo, stories about boys during horrific and life-changing times, like the AIDS epidemic, should be written by gay men. Why is this so hard to get? Schadenfreude is an easy reaction here. The guy who helped contribute to a stifling climate of plot policing and paranoia received the same treatment he had doled out to others. But the right response isn't to point and laugh, ha ha, like the bully Nelson Muntz on The Simpsons. It's to recognize that these online social dynamics constrain and distort young adult literature in unfortunate ways. These episodes will inevitably affect YA publishing and perhaps other areas of publishing if the fever spreads. This is now a pattern. It feels increasingly possible that at least some publishers, rather than adopt common-sense, liberal-minded approaches to the goals of increasing diversity and representation in YA fiction, will instead adopt norms in line with Jackson's tweet about gay stories. Only X's can write about X, and only Y's can write about Y. All because of an extremely small but incredibly loud group of Twitter users insatiable in their outrage. Imagine what a pointless, depressing loss that would be for readers of the future. When I solicited emails via Twitter from those in and around the YA community, some of the most depressing notes I got were from writers of color who've had bad experiences with white editors and agents telling them what they can and can't write about. I think the biggest thing I resent is that being told to stay in my lane, for me, apparently means writing about a country I wasn't born in, have only the vaguest connection to or knowledge about, and doesn't particularly interest me, one non-white writer told me. I'd much rather write about the Roman Empire or the Diadochi states after the collapse of Alexander's empire. But it's clear they want a very specific kind of own voices from me rather than letting me write about whatever I felt. A second writer, a Latina woman, mentioned that upon having her manuscript rejected by an agent, she couldn't help but wonder whether it was because she didn't hew enough to stereotype. I'm not completely certain race was why the agent rejected me, she wrote. I don't want to blame my failures on something I had no part in, but with the culture the way it is, it's difficult not to wonder and worry. It's very concerning and making race relations worse. It's created a double-edged sword for minorities. I feel like a mascot if I talk about my race, and I feel that if I play up my race to gain points with these people, I feed their fantasy narrative of how they're heroes saving minorities from whatever it is they think they're saving us from. The problem is that social media warps and distorts everything. Those most vociferous about their views on a given issue, in this case, Twitter mobs obsessing over the races of characters in YA novels, can fool everyone else into thinking they represent a reasonable majority. The publishing industry and authors themselves are going to have to learn to discount this funhouse mirror effect, or they are going to be a lot more canceled books. There's one encouraging data point. At the end of April, after the Kosoko Jackson controversy illuminated some of the excesses of YA cancel culture, Emily Wenzhou announced that, in fact, she would publish Blood Air. It's now scheduled for release in November. Most of the online responses I saw were positive, a useful reminder that it doesn't pay to give in to online bullies. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Reason magazine. Here's a couple of health articles, both centered around sugar. The first is ultra-processed foods lead to overeating. America's obesity epidemic is being fueled by ultra-processed foods loaded with synthetic flavors, preservatives, and added sugars and salt, a small but rigorous new study has found. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health recruited 20 adult volunteers, 10 men and 10 women, to spend a month at a research facility. The participants were split into two groups. One ate a diet of ultra-processed foods such as sugary cereals, white bread, and reconstituted meats, while the other group ate minimally processed foods such as fresh fruits and vegetables, grilled chicken, and whole grains. All meals contain similar amounts of calories, sugars, fat, and carbohydrates, but the subjects were told they could eat as much as they liked. After 2 weeks, the groups swapped meal plans. On the ultra-processed diet, participants ate faster and consumed an extra 500 calories a day, equivalent to 2.5 Krispy Kreme glazed donuts, and gained an average of 2 pounds. On the unprocessed diet, which was 40% more expensive than the ultra-processed one, subjects lost an average of 2 pounds and experienced increased levels of an appetite-suppressing hormone. Barry Popkin, a nutrition expert at the University of North Carolina, who wasn't involved in the study, tells NPR.org that the challenge for the global food industry is to produce ultra-processed food that's healthy and that won't be so seductive and won't make us eat so much extra. But they haven't yet. And in a similar vein, the health scare of the week says the dangers of fruit juice. Naturally occurring sugars in fruit juice may be just as bad for you as the refined sugars added to soda, a new study has found. Researchers examined data covering more than 13,000 people for more than 6 years. Almost 71% were overweight or obese. They found that the people who drank the most sugary drinks of any kind had a 14% higher risk of premature death than those who drank the least. Each additional daily 12-ounce serving of cola or other sugar-sweetened drinks was linked to an 11% increased risk. But for fruit juices, the risk was as much as 24% higher. While the authors cautioned that the study shows correlation, not causation, they say the elevated risk could be explained by the fact that sugary beverages increase insulin resistance, which raises the risk for cardiovascular disease, while fructose consumption can stimulate weight gain around the waist, another cardiovascular disease risk factor. Co-author Gene Welsh from Emory University in Atlanta tells CNN.com that the consumption of sugary beverages, whether soft drinks or fruit juices, should be limited. So here we are on the Talking Points page. And we're finally getting around to that UFO article. UFOs, why the military isn't scoffing anymore. After decades of blaming weather balloons, bird clusters, and odd clown formations, the U.S. military is finally taking UFOs seriously, said Helene Cooper in the New York Times. In December, the Pentagon acknowledged it had been studying them through the shadowy, little-known Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, AATIP, formed in 2007. In April, the Navy issued new guidelines on how pilots should report encounters. Now, 5 airmen have publicly described a host of strange objects they observed off the East Coast in 2014 and 2015. With no visible engine or exhaust plumes, the objects darted around at hypersonic speeds, making sudden stops and starts impossible for man-made craft, and nearly crashed into a pilot who came in for a closer look. "Wow, what was that, man?" one pilot exclaimed in a taped close encounter. "Look at it fly." "UFOs have finally come out of the fringe and into the mainstream," said Nick Pope in the New York Post. "We now have video of and details on multiple events where UFOs have been tracked on radar and chased by military jets, including a 2004 incident in which the USS Nimitz carrier strike group was buzzed by several high-speed objects. Last year, the Senate Armed Services Committee interviewed the Nimitz pilots, and the Defense Intelligence Agency briefed Congress on the AATIP's work. As a former UFO investigator for the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense, I can tell you, something is happening, something big. Let's not get carried away, said Mike Wall in Space.com. UFOs may exist, but that doesn't mean ET has been violating our airspace. The sightings may be experimental aircraft or drones from another nation, or the result of glitches in the jet's new radar systems. We can't say for sure these weren't alien spacecraft, just that the odds favor many possible prosaic explanations. Still, it would be closed-minded to rule out aliens, said Tyler Cowan in Bloomberg.com. Scientists are discovering more potentially life-supporting planets all the time. Humanity in the 21st century might be like Native Americans in the 15th, glimpsing wondrous sailing ships filled with strange beings approaching the shore. To be oblivious of another civilization for a long time and then suddenly encounter it is a common theme in human history. Perhaps this has not happened for the last time. Abortion, Hollywood's Georgia boycott. Hollywood's biggest companies are threatening to boycott Georgia over its fetal heartbeat abortion law, said Steven Zeitchik in WashingtonPost.com. Facing pressure from more than 100 stars, among them Ben Stiller, Amy Schumer, and Don Cheadle, Netflix's chief content officer vowed to rethink our entire investment in Georgia. The state, which offers large tax incentive to producers, has been dubbed Yollywood for the billions in entertainment industry business it attracts. It was the site of 455 TV and film productions last year, including Avengers Endgame. Disney, Warner Media, Sony, CBS, and NBC Universal also threatened to shun Georgia should its new abortion law take effect. Many people who work for us will not want to work there, said Disney CEO Bob Iger. With Hollywood's image tarnished by Me Too revelations, said Tara LaChapelle in Bloomberg.com, this boycott gives the industry a chance to stand up for the rights and safety of women. There's nothing brave about Hollywood's performance wokeness, said Stephen Kent in WashingtonExaminer.com. It's trying to score points with coastal elites without actually sacrificing Georgia's exceedingly generous tax breaks. Netflix, whose Georgia-based shows include Ozark and Stranger Things, was careful to say it will consider withdrawing from the state if the new abortion law takes effect January 1, knowing that the law is likely to get jammed up in the courts. Netflix and Disney are foolish to take up positions on the front lines of the cultural wars, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. They have customers in Macon as well as Manhattan, and it won't help business if these companies tell half the country they're deplorable. Boycotting Georgia may punish liberal allies as well as Republicans, said Zach Cheney Rice in NYMag.com. A recent poll found that 49% of Georgians opposed the new abortion law, with 44% in favor. Georgia is one of the blackest states in the country at 32%, and the Deep South is the cradle of black American culture, politics, and resistance. Abandoning Georgia and other so-called red states to the devices of their white leaders is a dubious strategy for change. Rather than punish the roughly 92,000 Georgians who work in the film industry, Hollywood should stay and fight. Studios and actors can donate to local organizations that are mounting legal challenges against the abortion law. Shunning Georgia would only make it redder. And here's a short note or two. Almost 30 million acres of U.S. farmland are owned by investors from Canada, Germany, China, and other foreign countries, a percentage that has doubled over the past two decades. Foreign ownership is expected to increase in the years to come because many American farmers are approaching retirement and have no family members willing to take over. The median age of U.S. farmers is 55 years old. Today, 35.7 million Americans live alone, or 28% of households. That's up from 13% of households in 1960 and 23% in 1980, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Demographers attribute the trend to delayed or foregone marriage, longer life expectancy, urbanization, and greater wealth. On the Poll Watch, when Americans were asked to name the best president in their lifetimes, 31% said Barack Obama. Ronald Reagan came in second with 21%, while Bill Clinton was named by 13%. Donald Trump was fourth at 10%. We had a bunch of good quotes this week, so I'm going to get at least two. Let's see. The first is from Bob Hope. Says, a bank is a place that will lend you money if you can prove that you don't need it. George Eliot says, blessed is the man who, having nothing to say, abstains from giving us wordy evidence of the fact. And we'll have to end it there. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That phone number is 919-832-5138.